font, the Frenchman said in a strangely even tone. From a brutal and murky upbringing in Toulouse, André Font had earned a reputation as a ferocious fighter. He had also paid attention in school and won a spot among some of France's sons of privilege at Saint-Cyr, the nation's equivalent of West Point or Sandhurst. Now 32, Font had served as an infantry lieutenant until the fall of France in 1940. Like Taillandier, he seethed with hatred for the Nazis and French collaborators. Also like Taillandier, Font had caught the attention of Colonel Payol and proved himself in several counterintelligence missions in northern France as a man with no qualms about killing Germans and traitors face to face. Payol described Font as a smart and perceptive officer and as the perfect top aide to Marcel Taillandier. Madame Rigal walked over to Arthur and clutched him tightly. She told him that she and Taillandier believed that Mimi Dumas talked too much. Taillandier leaned down to Mimi and whispered. She lifted her head from her hands, her face pallid. Then Taillandier nodded at Arthur and led him, Font, and the four other men out the door. Arthur glanced back at the house. Through the window, Madame Rigal stood above the still-seated Mimi Dumas, shaking her finger at the younger woman. Outside, no motorcycles or cars waited. As Font and two comrades walked down the street and turned a corner, Taillandier, Arthur, and the other two men waited. After 5 minutes passed, the two men headed in the same direction as Font's group. Only Taillandier and Arthur remained. Checking his watch several times, Taillandier scanned the street in both directions. Then he tapped Arthur's shoulder and began to stride down the street. Arthur caught up to him, and as they rounded the corner onto a winding cobblestoned road in the shadow of a well-preserved 13th-century defense wall and roof tower, a train whistle shrieked somewhere behind them. Taillandier quickened the pace. Although traveling by train was risky for the resistance, Taillandier knew that he could use the local railways for a few more weeks without worries of Allied planes attacking the tracks. Coded radio transmissions from London had alerted resistance leaders to the fact that in March 1944, the Allies would put the long-debated and controversial transportation plan into effect. The purpose of this plan was to conduct large-scale bombings to destroy any French rail centers and lines that the Germans could use to send reinforcements from anywhere in France when Operation Overlord, D-Day, began. Arthur followed Taillandier to a wider street named Rue Fermat-Maison. At the far end, perhaps 100 yards away, an elevated concrete platform rose from the street, covered by a hulking, sharply sloped red-tiled roof. A sign hanging above the platform read, Matabiau, Toulouse. The waiting area was not enclosed, and as they neared the steps to the platform, Taillandier's comrades separated and spread out among a dozen or so people, awaiting the mid-afternoon train to Toulouse. Smoking cigarettes, the Morange men all appeared to be alone and have no connection to each other. Taillandier and Arthur, holding a suitcase, climbed onto the platform just as the train pulled up. The passengers lined up in front of the second car and waited. A police officer in a dark blue greatcoat and kepi stepped from the train. Neither a uniformed nor a plainclothes Gestapo agent appeared behind him. As the official began to check identification cards, Taillandier pressed something into Arthur's free hand. It was a one-way ticket to Toulouse. Four of Taillandier's men stood in the line ahead of Arthur. Turning his head almost imperceptibly, Arthur spotted Font near the group's rear. Font's right hand was buried in his coat pocket. When Taillandier reached the police officer and carefully produced the identification card, the man did not even view it. Arthur was next, again staring woodenly at the officer's request, and then acting in sudden understanding. Georges handed over his card and papers. As with Taillandier, the policeman did not even look at them or at Arthur, gave them back, and waved him onto the train. The gendarme must have been paid off by Taillandier, or been one of his operatives. Arthur was now traveling with a far different type of resistance group than those he had met while in the care of Dr. Pierre Aurillac, Dr. Pierre Chauvin, and pharmacist Giselle Chauvin. While all of them were valiant and could certainly kill if they had to, Taillandier's men looked as though they liked to kill. Colonel Payol's orders to Taillandier were brutally simple. Paralyze the enemy and destroy the traitors. Men such as the late Alphonse Alfacer were necessary for that mission. Throughout southern France, a half-dozen repentant gangsters, who, despite their crimes, loved their nation and despised the Nazis and collaborators, had been recruited by Payol's agents and assigned to Morange for one simple reason. They had no qualms about killing any German or any man or woman who was a traitor to France. They would shoot, stab, strangle, run over, or blow up anyone on Taillandier's command. Payol did not condone unwarranted executions, ordering that the use of D, the death lists, measures, was to be systematic but in accordance with our rules. For Taillandier, the phrase, in accordance with our rules, was key. It gave him latitude to remove any Nazi or collaborator whom he believed it necessary to kill on his own initiative. In short, Payol gave Taillandier close to a free hand in deciding who was to die anywhere in the region. The men escorting Arthur to Toulouse served as Morange's hit team, and they did their jobs with savage efficiency. Arthur was seated beside Taillandier and next to a window from which he could watch the wooded foothills and ridges and ancient walled market towns of the Midi-Pyrénées quickly slide by. The American shifted his position to find Font glancing at him across the aisle, measuring him, probing for any hint of fear or weakness. Arthur did not look away. Once again, Font's lips curled up in that unreadable expression. He leaned back in his seat and closed his eyes. His right hand was still thrust deep into his coat pocket. Next to Arthur, Taillandier, who had obviously caught the silent exchange between his lieutenant and the airman, was wearing a hint of an approving smile. Most men averted their eyes instantly if Font looked at them. Staff Sergeant Meyerowitz had not lowered his gaze, even if he had wanted to do so. As the train steamed along the tracks, the Gestapo was poised to unleash a catastrophe for the resistance from Toulouse and Bordeaux to Le Spar. Chapter 14. Death in the Pink City. When the train chugged into Toulouse about an hour and a half after departing Beaumont de Lamagne, the sprawling city was bathed in the day's last shreds of twilight. Countless brick buildings gave off a pale, roseate glow that over the centuries had earned Toulouse the nickname the Pink City. The train slowed and inched its way into the giant station of Matabiau, among dozens of other trains from which passengers streamed onto broad platforms. Pairs of Nazi soldiers patrolled everywhere, many of them with German shepherds or Dobermans, ready to chase and pounce and tear apart anyone on their master's command. As soon as Taillandier stepped into the aisle, Arthur followed. They stepped off the train and into the crowd filling into the station's concourse and forming lines in front of Gestapo agents. Arthur had caught a break on the platform at Beaumont de Lamagne, thanks to Taillandier. However, the two Nazis checking the papers of the people ahead of him were taking their time with each passenger. Shouts suddenly erupted at the front of an identification inspection line. Taiyantye and everyone around Arthur instantly flung themselves onto the floor as the concourse rang with commands of, "Halt! Halt!" The Morange men hugged the tiles, and Arthur did the same. A young man in a tan coat desperately raced for the row of exit doors, a German shepherd closing fast behind him. He slipped on the tiles and crashed to the floor beneath one of the many blood-red, white, and black swastika banners hanging from the steel ceiling beams. An instant later, the dog leaped onto him and began to tear at his face and neck. As he screamed and tried to cover his face, Gestapo agents stood by and watched, grinning and pointing, and let the dog rip away part of an ear and the man's nose. Several soldiers ran up, and one called off the dog, who immediately stopped biting, but stood growling over the shrieking man. One of the agents then slammed his jack-booted foot several times into the man's face. As the Germans dragged the unconscious man away, people pushed themselves off the floor and reformed their lines, no one uttering a word. The concourse stayed eerily quiet for a minute. Then commands of, "I have papieren, your papers," filled the terminal again. Several pools of blood seeped across the tiles where the man had fallen. Now, as Taiyantye and Arthur reached the head of the line, Arthur's first personal encounter with the Toulouse Gestapo was at hand. The routine at the station always began the same way. At the agent's order, Taiyantye reached into his coat and presented his identification card and papers. The Germans examined them and returned them promptly. He moved out of the line and kept walking. Once again, the Nazis had no idea that Ricardo had walked right past them. Arthur waited as one of the Nazis demanded his identification card and papers. The German cocked his head, scowled at Arthur, and shouted a second time for the papers as heads turned toward them. Waving the clipboard while pointing to a piece of paper, the Gestapo agent pointed at Arthur until he showed a sudden understanding. Carefully, he opened his coat, reached into the lining pocket, slowly took out his card and papers, and handed them over. The Germans pored over his photo and documents, staring back at him and then to the photo several times. Arthur did not stir, keeping his hands in plain sight and straining to keep his face blank. Then, finally, one of the agents handed him back the papers. Arthur stepped past the Nazis cautiously. Again, hurried movements could attract unwanted scrutiny, and headed toward the long line of doors at the terminal's exit as one of the Germans bellowed for the next person in line. Outside the station, people filed towards city buses or down the broad Boulevard de Marengo on their way home before curfew. Taiyantye, in his black fedora and expensive black coat, met Arthur in front of the station, whose lofty Romanesque facade was decorated with 26 colorful coats of arms cut into the stone and representing each town the original station had served in 1856. Near the mammoth clock, another gargantuan red banner with a swastika was hung, flapping in the wind. Taiyantye glowered for an instant at the flag. After about a 40-minute walk from Matabiau, Taiyantye led Arthur onto another expansive street. The Boulevard del Tour, crowded on both sides by three-story brick townhouses and apartment buildings, many of them with ground-floor storefronts, cafes, and restaurants. Several of the buildings were mansions that had been passed down from one generation to the next. The two men picked their way along the crowded sidewalks, past a stunning granite hotel with gilded doors and giant arched windows. Somewhere behind them, Taiyantye's men followed. Taiyantye turned up the steps of a townhouse at 96 Boulevard del Tour and rapped the brass door knocker. A young woman in a mauve blouse and dark skirt answered, smiled at Taiyantye and Arthur, and let them inside. Before she closed the door, she looked up and down the street to make sure the men had not been tailed. She introduced herself as Mademoiselle Toulouse, daughter of the house's owner, Emmy Toulouse, who owned a paint store in the city center, and would be home soon to meet Arthur and Taillandier. She was Taillandier's chief supplier of stolen ration books, a wizard in the murky, dangerous black market. Unlike most of his previous stops, the American airman would not be concealed in an attic or a shed, but would be hiding in plain sight as Georges Lambert, Emmy Toulouse's new assistant at the paint store. Although the resistance preferred to arrange escapes for downed Allied pilots and airmen as quickly as possible, the snow and ice choking the trails from October to late May created virtually impassable conditions even for a man in top shape. With his back injury, Arthur was not yet ready for the rigors posed by a trek across treacherous mountain passes, even if it were summer. Taillandier not only needed to protect him by hiding him longer than usual, but also could not afford to put other escapees across the mountain routes in additional danger of being slowed down by an injured comrade. Arthur would have to stay in Toulouse until his back had healed, or until the Germans got too close. Every day, Arthur would have to leave the house to sweep the business's floors, dust the shelves, stock and restock the shelves, and run any number of errands for his boss. He would have a comfortable bedroom on the second floor, an arrangement that would raise few suspicions, as Toulouse's store owners often provided room and board for employees. He would take his meals with the family, and Morange would provide him with a ration card so that he would not deplete the family's own meager stores of rationed food. Like every other citizen, he was to stand and wait in long lines at nearby grocery markets and hope that the merchants did not run out of food before he got his allotted share. The ruse Arthur was expected to play was daunting. One misstep and he jeopardized everyone. Taillandier was placing enormous trust in him. He was told to rest for a day or two before starting his job. Meanwhile, the Toulouses began telling neighbors that they had hired a deaf-mute named Georges, who came from Algiers and was a Sulac-sur-Mer resident seeking work in Toulouse. His limp came from a farm accident that prevented him from doing agricultural work for a while. No one outside his resistance friends could ever suspect that his chronic limp was actually the result of a parachute jump from a burning B-24. While Arthur prepared for his new role, events that would place him in severe peril were taking shape in Bordeaux. The Gestapo, tipped off by informers and double agents, was closing in on Dr. Robert Neal, the head of Brutus in the Bordeaux region, and Jean-Pierre Dupin, and were searching for Dr. Pierre Aurillac, Georges Tissot, and other operatives of the network. The Nazis had also gotten their hands on a Brutus courier who had documents with names of several network leaders and regional chiefs. Prominent on those lists were Pierre and Giselle Chauvin. At a little before 11 a.m. on February 20, 1944, Neil strolled into the Café des Halles in Bordeaux, found a small white cloth table near the front window, and tried not to appear too anxious as he peered at the entrance. He was supposed to meet with a courier and another Brutus agent, a young French naval officer. The brasserie was already packed with people taking an early lunch. Many sipped coffee as the café, frequented by Germans and locals alike, was one of the few spots in the city where the brew at least tasted better than the watery mess that passed for coffee anywhere else in Bordeaux. As the minutes passed, neither man came through the door. Neil remained outwardly calm, but tension seeped through him. Something was wrong. Finally, he rose from the table and left the café. Historian Bernard Boyer writes, "He, the naval officer, would not come to the appointment given to him by his superior, Dr. Robert Neal, at the Café des Halles. Earlier that morning, the Gestapo had tried to arrest the officer, but he had put up a fight, taking down two agents with his revolver before dying at a military hospital from his wounds. He had been dead for hours before Neal went to the café." Neil headed down the street toward the small office where he and his operatives met in secret. Boyer relates, "The head of the Bordeaux region, wanting to do too much, then made a mistake. He rushes to the office at Tondu Street." Waiting there for Neil were four French police officers who were collaborators and part of a special anti-terror unit. They seized him and turned him over to the Gestapo. The search for his colleagues, Jean-Pierre Dupin, Dr. Pierre Aurillac, and Georges Tissot was underway. The Gestapo was also about to pounce on Pierre and Gisèle Chauvin. Chapter 15. The Gestapo at the door. At 7 a.m. on February 27, 1944, in Le Spar, the ringing doorbell and sharp knocks brought Simone Blanchard, the Chauvin's maid, to the front door of the house. Upstairs in the dining room near the wood stove and still clad in her dressing gown, Gisèle wondered who was on her stoop so early. The pharmacy was not yet open, as almost everyone in Le Spar would have known, and she and Pierre were not expecting any new guests. Pierre, who was planning to visit several patients on his motorcycle, was in the children's bedroom talking with his mother-in-law and helping the children to get dressed. Simone opened the door to find three well-dressed men. Sneering, one introduced himself and his companions as Dupont, Duron, and Dubois. Despite their French names, something seemed off about them, and Simone hesitated. In that instant, they pulled out pistols, pushed into the house, and grabbed her. She screamed to alert Pierre and Gisèle, and struggled for a moment to try to break their grip, but quickly stopped, realizing that they were a Gestapo, and that resistance was useless. As the clamor moved up the stairs toward the dining room, Pierre instinctively took a step to join his wife there, but stopped. He and Gisèle had discussed what they might do in a situation like this, and had agreed that if one of them could escape capture and alert the rest of the Brutus network that the Gestapo was onto them, that's what they had to do. As hard as it would be, they had to do it. Though he despised leaving the house, he realized he had no choice. He climbed out the children's bedroom window and onto the roof above the vacant pigsty and jumped to the backyard. As more Gestapo arrived in dark sedans and poured into the house, several Germans emerged through the back door and fanned out across the small yard. It did not take long to find the doctor's hiding spot, haul him to his feet, and begin a harsh interrogation on the spot. Inside, the three agents shoved the ashen-faced Simone upstairs and into the dining room, where Gisèle waited. One of the Nazis pointed his pistol at her and growled, "You will come with us." Upstairs from Gisèle, the Germans had rounded up the rest of the family. The three children and Gisèle's mother, 58-year-old Mercedes Lacombe, who lived with them, were in the master bedroom. Gisèle, knowing there was no chance of escape, was determined to delay the Nazis long enough for her mother to destroy the Brutus paperwork, fake ID cards, communiques, codes, and other damning evidence hidden in an armoire conveniently placed close to the bedroom's fireplace for just such a moment. Gisèle forced a slight smile at them. She insisted that if they were to take her away for questioning, proper German gentlemen would first allow her to bathe and change. After a brief discussion, the head agent nodded brusquely to her and told her to make it fast. Gisèle had other ideas. The moment she saw the young agent assigned to stand guard between the open doors of the bathroom and the bedroom, she improvised a plan. The other men pounded down the stairs to join the rough interrogation of Pierre. Gisèle tried to ignore the shouts from below.
Mercedes Lacombe watched the guard, anticipating that her daughter would try to divert his attention. Mercedes, a patriot like her daughter and Pierre, knew the drill.
Whoever was closest to the papers at such a moment was responsible for destroying them. If the Gestapo found the Bertuz documents, torture and possible execution awaited Giselle, Pierre, and herself. The fate of the children would be anyone's guess. Seizure of the papers would also doom Arthur Meyerowitz and the other airman Bertuz was helping. As soon as she felt the young Nazi's eyes on her, Giselle began filling the tub, slowly unbuttoned her blouse, then slipped out of her skirt. She knew that it would be enough to hold his attention. Turning her back to him, she finished undressing and stepped into the tub. Leaning against the doorframe, mesmerized, the agent watched her clean herself with the warm, soapy water. Mercedes, less than 6 feet from the guard peering into the bathroom, called out to the agent and asked if she could light a fire because the children were cold. He did not even turn from the bathroom, staring at Giselle, and snapped, "Oui."
Mercedes hastily lit the bedroom's fireplace, removed the papers from the armoire, and tossed them into the blaze as fast as she could.
Sensing that her daughter would step from the tub shortly, and that the Nazi agent might turn and see what the grandmother was doing at the fireplace, she slipped over to Patrick's crib, picked him up, cradled him in one arm, and used her free hand to stuff the last few papers into his diaper. When Giselle finished dressing, Mercedes, who was crying, came over to her and held up Patrick for his mother to kiss for what both women believed was the final time. 9-year-old Jean-Claude and 6-year-old Monique rushed up to hug their mother, who blinked back tears. The German who had watched her in the bathroom tore Giselle from her children and escorted her down the stairs and outside to the waiting Gestapo sedans. Although she could not see her neighbors looking through shutters at the scene, she felt their eyes on her. Most, she knew, were terrified for the Chauvins. She did not dare glance in the direction of Pierre and Mimi Delude's house, just across the street from the Chauvins, and in the same block of buildings as Gestapo headquarters. She prayed that they were not next. As the agents opened the rear passenger door of a sedan and ordered her inside, she stiffened at the sight of Pierre, whose face was battered, being shoved into another car. She suspected that it was likely her last glimpse of her husband, and that she would never see her mother, her children, or her home again. Having found no evidence in the house, the Gestapo left Giselle's mother, the three children, and Simone behind, and sped off to the Villa Calypso with Giselle, who knew what awaited her there. It is uncertain whether the Gestapo took Pierre just across the street to their Lespar headquarters or elsewhere, but he was not brought to the same spot as his wife. The fate of Arthur, Bertuz, and the other Allied fighters helped by the Chauvins lay in how the couple stood up to their coming ordeal. Chapter 16. Hiding in Plain Sight. The news that the Gestapo and the police had shattered Bertuz and arrested its leaders spread throughout southern France. In London and in Algiers, where Free French and British intelligence units had set up shop after the Allied invasion of North Africa, the fallout from the February 1944 ambushes in Toulouse and Bordeaux was alarming. If Jean-Pierre Dupin, Giselle Chauvin, and other captured Bertuz agents cracked under torture, the Nazis would surely show up at the homes of the network's other associates. By early March 1944, Arthur had learned to play his part well. He turned into Georges Lambert every time he left Emmy Toulouse's old three-story stone house at 96 Boulevard del Tour. Neighbors usually greeted the handsome young man with a wave or a smile, but not with words. As far as they knew, Georges was a deaf-mute from Algiers and a Soulac-sur-Mer resident who was visiting Toulouse from the coastal town. As Arthur's confidence and ability to feign deafness and a complete lack of speech grew, he started to explore Toulouse, He wasn't sightseeing, however, but instead doing reconnaissance. In briefings on how pilots and airmen were to seek help and conduct themselves if shot down, lecturers had told crewmen that if they were presented with any opportunity to reconnoiter enemy positions, movements, or to gather potentially useful information about the German forces and targets for Allied bombers, they were to take it. Later, if they escaped from France, they were expected to write down their observations for American and British intelligence officers. When he was not helping out at Toulouse's paint store during his first few Sundays in the city, the American walked among the crowds of the Grand Place du Capitole, passing chapels, churches, Gothic cathedrals, and splendid old mansions, such as the sprawling Hôtel d'Azeza. He noted the faces and morale of the thousands of German troops occupying Toulouse. He strolled along the Canal du Midi, which connected the Garonne River to the Mediterranean, and made a mental note that the Pont Neuf and other railway bridges across the river offered inviting targets for bombers. He did the same every time he spotted German supply depots and barracks. He was somewhat surprised at either how young or how old many of the soldiers were. To Arthur, many of the Germans looked as though they had served in World War I. He was right. Nazi casualties on the Eastern Front against the Soviets were staggering, forcing the Germans to press teenagers and old veterans into service. Arthur found a city swarming with Germans, always looking over their shoulders for any hint of resistance operatives about to launch an ambush or peering skyward for any sign of Allied bombers. For the first few weeks of March 1944, the Allies bombed targets outside the city, but not Toulouse itself. All of that was about to change as the countdown to the invasion of Fortress Europe began in earnest. Plastered on the walls of buildings all over Toulouse were posters urging citizens to turn in Jewish neighbors to the authorities and depicting them as half-rat, half-human. Arthur did not have to read French to understand the savage messages on those placards. No matter how many times he viewed them, anger simmered inside him. Even worse, many times he stopped in his tracks as the Gestapo dragged men, women, and children from apartment buildings and shops, or simply grabbed them on the streets. The Germans' shouts of "Juden!" pealed through the air, and Arthur could do nothing except watch as the Nazis pummeled the men and sometimes the women with fists, jackboots, and batons. The beating stopped only when a truck rolled up, and the Gestapo tossed the Jews into the back. Their next stop was the train station, and a long, hopeless journey northeast to the concentration camps. His head throbbing from the scenes, Arthur yearned to get back into the fight. Wherever he went in the city, swastikas surrounded him. Not only were Nazi flags draped above the doorways of every public building, but they also fluttered from every flagpole. Banners with the loathsome symbol were affixed to street lamps and trees. Giant gilded brass eagles, whose talons grasped lightning bolts and swastikas, were attached to walls throughout Toulouse. In every corner of the city, there was no escaping the Nazis' emblems of occupation. Arthur learned that life in occupied Toulouse meant shortages of food and virtually every consumer good. For all but well-connected citizens, or those with access to the black market, rationed food was poorly or indifferently distributed. Malnourishment, especially among children and the elderly, was rampant. The Germans seized 20% of all crops, meat, and dairy products from the farmland outside the city. Making matters worse, fertilizer and gas for farm vehicles were in short supply, hampering production because farmers had to use their own muscle or spindly old horses to work the fields. Near-empty shelves were common in every food store Arthur entered. With German officials setting the policies, hunger prevailed. Arthur stood for hours in the long queues in front of food shops and was grateful that his diet was augmented by the black market dealings of Taillandier and his Morange operatives. In the rural safe houses outside Toulouse, however, he had found food more plentiful. Farmers, who were not always under the scrutiny of the Germans and the Vichy police, secretly slaughtered livestock, planted hidden vegetable gardens, and hid milk and cheese. Through Mademoiselle Toulouse's skills in amassing counterfeit and stolen ration books and coupons, Taillandier had access to additional sources of food, and also dealt them on the black market to help fund Morange's lethal operations. He also garnered a sizable stash of francs and Reichmarks, Nazi currency, by trading ration books, food, liquor, and cigarettes for weapons. Many of those arms were smuggled in from Algiers or dropped for the resistance at night by Allied planes. Much of Taillandier's illicit money went to purchase one of the region's scarcest commodities, gasoline. Taillandier hoarded the precious fuel for Morange's hit-and-run operations, such as the Courier de Nice ambush in January 1944. At 96 Boulevard del Tour, Taillandier visited Arthur often and also met there with key Morange members. Taillandier included Arthur in nearly all of the gatherings, and because the operatives, several women among them, conversed only in hushed French, Taillandier would turn to Arthur and explain much of what the agents were discussing. Because the Morange leaders obviously trusted the American airmen, the others quickly accepted him as one of them, at least in some ways. Arthur came to know several of the Morange leadership well, but only by their first names. They made certain that they never mentioned their surnames in front of him, but not because they did not trust him. It was far safer for him not to know their complete names in case he fell into Gestapo hands. He sat down on numerous occasions with Taillandier and André Font, who had four fingers off his left hand from an injury he suffered during the fall of France in 1940. A crafty Morange agent named Ginot had infiltrated and worked with the Toulouse Gestapo and had full access to their operations and documents. Additionally, he and Taillandier had five other plants inside the local Gestapo. The man whom Arthur knew only as Leo was one of Morange's bravest and most cunning leaders under Taillandier's command. Henri was a Vichy police officer and one of Taillandier's most trusted operatives. At the wheel of a Citroën sedan, for scores of Morange hits of Nazis and collaborators, was Robert, a gifted chauffeur. Arthur came to know all of them, as well as Yvonne, a young operative who came often to Toulouse's house for the meetings. On numerous occasions, Taillandier took Arthur for lunch or dinner at the Frascati, the downtown Toulouse café that was always crammed not just by the locals, but also by Vichy police, German soldiers, and Gestapo. Arthur realized that the attractive women who worked at the café were actually prostitutes who used the bedroom upstairs to service clients, and also to pry useful intelligence from Nazis and collaborators and pass it on to Taillandier. In meetings at Toulouse's house, Taillandier had told Arthur several times that he and his girls blackmailed French police and collaborators to provide information to Morange. Often, Taillandier's operatives forced them to pass sensitive intelligence to Morange or be tried and executed at Chateau de Brox. None of them ever saw Taillandier unless they refused to cooperate, in which case his face was among the last the collaborators ever saw. He made certain that no one could connect him in any way to the unit. To the patrons of the Frascati, Taillandier appeared the very picture of a dapper French professional. His neat, pencil-thin mustache, dark, slicked-back hair, and well-tailored suit made him fit in perfectly. Arthur sipped his wine, admiring how Taillandier practiced what he preached about hiding in plain sight. The often ruthless Morange chief moved seamlessly among his enemies. Once, when a known collaborator confronted Taillandier at the café and demanded proof that he was not a member of the resistance, Taillandier sprang from his chair and knocked out the accuser with one swift punch. Standing over him, He shouted that no one could accuse him of being a member of the resistance and get away with such a lie. His outrage duped the Gestapo agents, watching with both amusement and alertness as several of his associates dragged the man out the back door. The man's fate is unknown, but it seems reasonable to assume he disappeared. Arthur did not want to be taken alive by the Nazis, and wanted a pistol so that he could go out fighting if the Gestapo tried to seize him. Again and again he asked Marcel for one. Taillandier was reluctant to comply, knowing that if the American, a Jewish American no less, was ever discovered to be concealing a weapon, it would be all over for him. Arthur was subjected to increasing stop and checks by the Gestapo and police in mid-March. The American and British air forces were launching the transportation plan to soften up the Nazis for the imminent invasion. By day, American bombers pounded targets on the city's outskirts, where Nazi munition dumps were camouflaged but identified by the resistance for Allied air power. By night, it was the Royal Air Force's turn. The bombers left the city center, which was devoid of bona fide military targets, alone. Even though Allied intelligence, thanks to the resistance, knew where Gestapo headquarters and outposts in the heart of Toulouse were located, they did not strike the city center, believing that civilian casualties among the patriotic French would far surpass any damage to the Nazis. Though Taillandier had insisted several weeks earlier that the American go outside every day, and Arthur was not afraid to do so, he did wonder if the escalating searches by the Gestapo and heightened fears among neighbors who collaborated with the Nazis might make some question the identity of Monsieur Toulouse's guest. During one of Taillandier's frequent visits to the house on the Boulevard del Tour, Arthur asked him, "Wouldn't it be safer for all of you if I were to stay inside more?" Marcel, knowing that Arthur now relished his cautious forays into the city, leaned back on a battered divan, lit a cigarette, and took a drag. Smiling, he explained that with the Nazis and the police growing more anxious by the day, anything out of the ordinary attracted attention. If a suspicious neighbor noticed that Georges Lambert was suddenly absent, the Gestapo would show up at Monsieur Toulouse's door. Arthur was confronted the very next day. He left the house and walked to an open-air market to buy bread and fruit. Suddenly, a Gestapo agent in the blood-chilling black uniform and jackboots emerged from behind a produce stall, munching an apple. He peered at Arthur, took a bite of the apple, and hurled it at Arthur's shoes. The German strode up to him, Arthur's heart racing. When the German snarled for the Frenchman to produce his papers, Arthur hoped that his face showed no tinge of anything more than the natural fear anyone would have for the Germans at that time. Arthur stared at him as if confused, then nodded in sudden understanding, and reached into his jacket pocket for his identification card and the letter embossed with the signature and official seal of the mayor of Sulac-sur-Mer, and attesting that the bearer was town resident Georges Lambert. The agent glared at the photo identification card and letter, grunted something, flung them at Arthur, and stomped away to stop another passerby. The people of Toulouse were subjected to daily stop and checks. Even though the risk of discovery threatened him every time he went out, his practiced self-discipline and dread of capture had turned him into Georges Lambert to the outside world. In public, Arthur never reacted to loud noises, never reacted to voices, and never spoke. He communicated only through hand gestures. Although he had picked up some French in the week since Harmful Lil Armful had gone down, he never spoke a word of it outside the safe house. In late March 1944, Arthur took a bus to the city center of Toulouse to bring Monsieur Toulouse his lunch. A baguette, cold chicken, and fruit. As always, when Arthur stepped off the bus in front of the store, he fought a cold flush of fear raised by the giant swastika flag that was draped above the entrance of the adjacent building, the local Gestapo headquarters. Agents in black uniforms, with skull and crossbones adorned caps, or dark suits with low-brimmed black fedoras, bustled in and out of the building. It was a medieval structure with narrow slit windows, parapets, and two steel front doors. To Arthur, it reeked of the horrors of the Inquisition, and now those of the Gestapo. He shivered slightly, and headed from the bus stop toward the store. A tall man in a black uniform strode down the steps of the headquarters, folded his arms, and fixed his light blue eyes beneath his visor on Arthur. Arthur walked by him as casually as he could.
"Halt!"
The harsh command exploded in Arthur's ears, but he kept walking as he had been trained to do.
"Halt!"
the agent barked a second time. As Arthur approached Toulouse's door and reached for the knob, a huge hand clamped down on his forearm and spun him around. The Gestapo agent released his grip and leaned so close to Arthur that he could smell beer and onion on the man's breath.
"Papieren!"
the German snarled. Every Frenchman and woman knew the word now. Papers. Arthur stared with practiced confusion at him, saying nothing. Glaring, the Nazi shouted again at Arthur to show his papers. The agent took a step back, sizing up the Frenchman in his patched overcoat and neat but old brown woolen suit and worn shoes. Arthur widened his eyes, raised his hands slowly with his palms up as if in supplication, and shook his head. The German cocked his head, appraised Arthur for several seconds, and then reached into his pocket. He produced his Gestapo identification card and pointed to it. For a few more moments, Arthur feigned confusion. Suddenly he nodded and reached carefully into his coat. He pulled out his ID card and documents. The Gestapo agent studied the photo and looked up at Arthur at least a half dozen times. Frowning, he handed the papers back, and as Arthur tucked them back in his overcoat, the German stepped quietly behind him. Arthur noticed the movement, steeling himself not to flinch no matter what the Nazi did. Still, Arthur would not have been surprised if his face somehow reflected the sudden dryness in his throat and tightness in his chest.
Clap, clap!
Arthur felt every muscle constrict at the sound of those two giant hands slamming into each other, but did not react. He remained still. Finally, the German stepped back in front of him and thrust a thick forefinger in his face. As the man's lips twisted into a sneer, he fixed his cold, pale blue eyes on the American. Arthur's jaw tightened, but he did not flinch, not a muscle quivering with any hint that he understood. The German wagged his finger several times in Arthur's face, still sneering. The German demanded an answer in English, waiting for any flicker of a response. To trip up Allied airmen posing as civilians, the Nazis routinely snapped questions in English during stop-and checks. Arthur looked back at him vacantly. The German stepped back, grinned maliciously, and backed away a few steps. He turned, laughed, and stomped away. Arthur did not budge until the German vanished around a corner. As Arthur finally returned to the paint shop, Monsieur Toulouse opened the glass door. Arthur, his face pale, hoped he would not run into the Gestapo agent again, although he would now watch for him every second. It became obvious over the next few days that the man was also watching for Arthur. Whenever he got off the bus to walk over to the paint store, the agent was always standing on the sidewalk nearby, smoking and staring at him with a tight smile. Arthur tried to vary the times of his trips back and forth from Toulouse's shop, but it did not matter. The Nazi was always lurking, always watching for Georges Lambert. Although Arthur feared that the Gestapo agent
would one day follow him to 96 Boulevard del Tour. The man seemed content for the moment with tracking him from the bus to the store. A week after his first brush with the suspicious German, Arthur was sitting with Taillandier and another Mirage agent over lunch at a white cloth table near the Frascati's gleaming marble-topped bar. As Taillandier and the other man chatted in a low tone, Arthur played his usual role of Georges, unable to hear a sound. Taillandier rose from his seat and walked over to the bar, where he began speaking to the bartender. The door to the cafe swung open. Three uniformed Gestapo agents strutted into the restaurant, scanned the crowded room, and walked up to a table near Arthur's, their hobnailed boots clattering against the floorboards. Arthur's eyes widened. There was no mistaking it. The massive Gestapo agent, who was so suspicious of him just a week prior, now loomed a few feet from his table and was looking right at him. From the bar, Taillandier caught the look that the German shot at the American, and edged subtly to the end of the bar, out of the German's line of vision. The trio stopped. A portly agent wearing a major's insignia pointed at the other table's two middle-aged Frenchmen and their female companions. Two young women in low-cut dresses and slit skirts, unquestionably expensive prostitutes. The major ordered the two men to disappear and the women to remain with the snap of his fingers. The men sprang from their chairs and startled a busboy right behind Arthur's table. The youth stumbled and dropped his overloaded bin of dishes, glasses, and utensils. Heads turned to the crash of ceramic, glass, and metal. Arthur and his two companions leaped from their chairs. The giant Gestapo agent smiled at Arthur, and then lunged at him with frightening speed. Before he could pin Arthur's arms, Arthur slipped his identification card and paper out of his jacket and under the table too quickly for the German to detect. Taillandier saw Arthur's move, eased behind the bar, and waited. An instant later, the Nazi grabbed Arthur. Georges Lambert could obviously hear something. Another Gestapo man handcuffed Arthur, and the three dragged him out the door. Arthur knew where they were headed. He knew he was a dead man. Taillandier had vanished out the back door of the cafe, but not before waiting for the Gestapo to leave and deftly scooping up Arthur's identification card and papers. By the time that one of the three Gestapo agents thought to race back into the Frascati to look for anyone who had been with Arthur, both Taillandier and the other agent were long gone. Arthur was tossed into a dank windowless cell in the Gestapo headquarters, next to the paint store. In an hour, two Gestapo agents in plain clothes stepped into his cell and closed the door. They removed their jackets and rolled up their white shirt sleeves. One pulled Arthur to his feet, twisted his arms behind his back, and held him so that he faced the other German. The man in front of Arthur said something to him in French. Arthur remained silent. Then in English, the agent said, "Tell us the names of your friends at the restaurant, and we might let you live." Arthur stared blankly. Again, the Gestapo agent asked something in French, and then in English, "Why don't you have an ID and photo? Who are you?" He waited a few seconds for an answer. When none came, the German suddenly slammed his fist into Arthur's stomach. The breath rushed from him, the hammerlock on his arms preventing him from doubling over. Again and again, the Nazi's fist thudded against Arthur's stomach. Still, he said nothing. A swift, savage kick to Arthur's groin caused him to pass out. The German behind him released his grip and shoved the airman to the floor. Slowly he came to, pain rippling through him.
Kicks now rained on him from every angle, to his face, his torso, his arms and legs. Drifting in and out of consciousness, he lost track of time. All he sensed was the pain everywhere. At some point, the agents pulled him from the floor and tied him to the cell's sole piece of furniture, a cracked, sagging wooden chair. One of them tossed a pail of frigid water in his face. Grinning, the Nazi said in French, "Wake up." His comrade grabbed Arthur's chin, squeezed hard, and turned his face upward.
"Now, your name,"
he hissed, again in French. Arthur said nothing. The German's fist smashed against Arthur's left ear and sent the chair careening at a wall. Arthur crashed against the stone and grunted as he and the chair toppled to the floor. Both Germans loomed over him. The kicks thudded into him again for several minutes before the pair picked him up and drove the chair upright against the floor. His eyes were nearly closed from the swelling tissue around them, and the Germans' faces were hazy. Arthur gagged from the blood pouring from his mouth to his throat.
"Your name!"
exploded in French again in his ears, and then in English. Arthur did not answer. The two men kicked the chair back to the floor and rained kicks on Arthur's ribs, back, and stomach. Finally, the blows ceased. Arthur was barely aware of the Gestapo agents untying him, flinging him into a corner, and leaving him alone in the cell to await their return. Chapter 17. Not a moment too soon. Taillandier did not flee the city. Despite de Gaulle's directive not to become too involved in escape and rescue of Allied airmen, Taillandier had no intention of abandoning Arthur to the Gestapo. However, he had to move fast before the torture began. Mere hours were all that he had. But he knew someone who just might be able to stroll into Gestapo headquarters and emerge unchallenged with Arthur. Even though it could jeopardize the survival of Morange, Taillandier had made up his mind. He could not let the Germans go to work on the brave airmen. Taillandier circled back to the town center, skirting the Gestapo headquarters. He strolled into another medieval-era structure with damp, grimy stone walls, the local police station. There, the Vichy police decided whether to rough up locals before turning them over to the Gestapo or to simply bring them to the Germans. In Toulouse, the police killed only one member of the resistance. The Gestapo did the rest, torturing and executing many French men and women first arrested by the police. As far as Taillandier and Morange were concerned, the police were collaborators and traitors. Scores of policemen were gunned down in Toulouse by Morange, or tried, executed, and buried at the Chateau de Brox. Taillandier slipped the desk clerk an envelope with the usual amount of francs, and asked him to tell Henri that a friend needed to speak with him immediately in the usual place. Taillandier walked out of the station and darted through a boulevard teeming with cars, trucks, and military vehicles to a small brasserie. He stepped inside, his eyes adjusting to the low-wattage lamps that did little to illuminate the dark-walled, dark-draped interior. Nodding to the elderly man sipping coffee and reading a paper behind the scarred bar, Taillandier slid into a booth near the rear exit, pulled the threadbare curtains closed, and waited for Henri. 15 minutes later, the curtains parted to reveal a short, wiry, middle-aged man in the Legionnaire cap and dark blue uniform of the reviled Vichy police. He sat in the frayed leather seat opposite Taillandier, pulled the curtain shut, and peered through his tight-fitting pince-nez glasses at him. Taillandier took out a gold case and offered the policeman a cigarette, which he accepted and lit. Henri, a captain in the Vichy police,
was one of Taillandier's most trusted and cunning agents, and had met Arthur a number of times at Toulouse's house. Taillandier relied on Henri and other Morange operatives who had infiltrated the Vichy police and even the Gestapo, spying on the enemy.